WOO Portland.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The following program is a rebroadcast. For all of KBOO's archived audio, please visit our website at kboo.fm.
Hello, you're listening to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, keeping Portland safe and in touch. Community radio has never been more important than here in the time of COVID. You can donate via the KBOO website at kboo.fm/give. There's also a donate button in the mobile app, or you can text KBOO to 44321. But the best way to support KBOO is by becoming a member at kboo.fm/give. KBOO is a nonprofit, listener-supported community resource for people like you. This is Wider Window Poetry, and I am your host, Teal Ansari, bringing you voices you may not have heard from places you may not have been. But first, a word about the places where you are. KBOO Portland is located on land that includes traditional village sites of the Multnomah, Wasco, Cowlitz, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Bands of Chinook, Tualatin, Kalapuya, Molalla, and many other tribes who made their homes along the Columbia and Willamette Rivers, creating communities and summer encampments to harvest and use the plentiful natural resources of the area. Portland is home to almost 70,000 people descended from these tribes and others. As a latecomer to this region, descended from slaves and immigrants, I thank the indigenous peoples of the Portland area for this place of refuge. I do have a guest this month, but first I'd like to read a couple of poems by Santee Frazier. Santee Frazier is a citizen of the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma, earned a BFA from the Institute of American Indian Arts and an MFA from Syracuse University. He's the author of the poetry collections Orem and Dark 30. Frazier's honors include a fall 2009 Lannan Residency Fellowship and the 2001 Truman Capote Scholarship from the Institute of American Indian Arts Creative Writing Program, and he is the director of the Institute of American Indian Arts Low Residency MFA Program. I'm going to read two poems by Santee Frazier. The first is titled Blue Top. Her head bangs against the window and dash when I stop and turn. My legs too short to work the brakes. Mama's crooked brow, her makeup smearing away, slurs something about good old boy music, a pint of Kentucky Deluxe in her hand. 2 hours, she said, and 3 days later, Tuesday, she's finally wanting to stop. I'm getting better at the turns, guiding her cutlass through these hills, 10 miles an hour, gravel roads, the cutlass rattling out the last fumes of gas. Engine stops, the night dimly lit by the moon hung over the treetops, owls calling each other from hilltop to valley bend. The radio fades in and out of static, tractors revving, cows lowing, and we may never make it back, home still 5 hills away, daylight coming over rocky edges of the hills. That was Blue Top by Santee Frazier. I'm also going to read a poem titled The Carnival. I studied every ride on the Midway, watched them groan, twirling light into blur, the Ferris wheel's last passengers pointing out from their seats to town's end. These monuments that have risen between the hills to be forgotten as the lights go out. Where was she in this hazy night? maybe half lit in red oak bar, leaning on a man wedged between his thighs. I wonder what it is to dream of autumn, balled up on a park bench, the tilt-a-whirl in my gaze, wanting a passing car to take me to her. Among these monuments, I am too small to find my way to the sandbanks where she sometimes takes a man, where sometimes I wander, skipping stones, while she earns in the back seat of a car or under a gun rack. It's hours like these you learn the path of a ditch, quiet only the huffers know. Day breaks. The carnies have loaded up the rides, heading out of town in a convoy, leaving nothing behind, not even the grass. And that was The Carnival by Santee Frazier. This month's guest, I'd like to welcome Ulrich Casimir, a native of North Carolina. He has taught writing, literature, and film at colleges and universities across the country. He holds a BA from North Carolina State University and an MFA in creative writing from the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, and holds both an MA and a PhD in English from the University of Oregon, where for the past several years he's taught writing and film for the English department, for cinema studies, and for Clark Honors College. Ulrich's scholarly work has appeared in the film journal Jump Cut. His short fiction has most recently appeared in Plain Songs. His first collection of short stories, Children of the Night, was published by Corpus Callosum Press in the spring of 2018. Welcome, Ulrich.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing all right. You're listening to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. This is Wider Window Poetry, and my guest is Ulrich Casimir. And without further ado, I'd like to invite you to go ahead and start reading.
Okay. I've got a poem and a couple of short stories I'd like to read today. I'm going to start off with the poem, if that's okay.
Great.
Okay. The poem is called On Our Wedding Night. When silence comes, the leaves twitch, and we wait, where the moon bleaches fabric, where the light should fall across our bed and become our very first spark, when passion should come in the dark, all the leaves blow, and we wait. Hard shift to a brief short story. And this one's from the collection. I'll start with a shorter one. This one's called Stars of Gold. And for those of you that have never been to Raleigh, North Carolina, it's called the City of Oaks for good reason. There are oak trees all over the place. And instead of on New Year's Eve, instead of a big, you know, glamorous ball dropping from the sky, it's a huge acorn that Raleigh does instead of the big ball that everybody's accustomed to. So I think that'll help a little bit with this piece. This one's called Stars of Gold. In lockup, Denny had never begged God for anything, not once. Not for goods or for paper, not for the type of girl or family who would bother to maintain contact, not for the love it would take anyone to visit after he disappointed them all so deeply. He bent, sure, in the damp and noisome darkness, same as the other used up, wadded up men on his block, talking to the concrete, chatting with a God you just had to believe was listening. He never begged, but toward the end, he'd arrived at a bargain. Lord, if I find work my first year out, I will do good at it, whatever it is. I will live past what brought me to this place. Prayers, pleas, lamentations of the stretch he'd spent in the city, bad decisions, worse mistakes. 10 years of arthritic knees stitched to that prison floor until finally they earned his plea. Paroled, and a job as a hot dog vendor in his hometown of Brooklyn, handed to him by a sympathetic lesbian barely a month after his release. Old and dusty memories, Denny thought, which on this cold and rainy evening went together like some sweet and heady set in the wind. He had served her quickly, that harried girl. Blonde, vanity plates, a bumper sticker that surprisingly read Shaw, the Black College, in cursive. Tonight, the most selfish night of the year, and this young girl spoke and moved like a woman with a place, with some place to be. People she loved, folks she missed. Maybe that's why she reminded him so much of the way he felt in prison. He'd sped through her order because he could tell she wanted him to, given her directions to the airport without the usual banter, taken her money, counted her change. But there was that scent again, sweet and everywhere, and Denny began to think of Stella. Tonight, these memories of his were an ache that just would not quit. He'd worked that first job all 3 years of parole, neither a sick day nor vacation, keeping his promise before heading south, back when most blacks were still running north. He brought his own cart back then, same one that he ran now. Denny's Coney Island, true boardwalk barkers with real trimmings for transplants like him, who were always missing home. But this girl, Denny breathed deeply, shook his head, smiled, put his hand on hers to calm her, wished her a happy new year. She blushed and she thanked him. He scraped her money into his pouch, sighed, and heard her peel off. Then he started sausages for three brunettes, maybe 17, who snapped their bracelets and touched Denny's face without asking, and went on about Moore Square, how they were headed there with practically everybody but him, haha, to watch the acorn drop. Exact change. They left, and in the dim light and steady rain stood the starched black uniform of the limo driver. He was tall, the limo driver, Italian, short black hair and engraved wedding band. Street traffic washed in pulses behind him as he shifted foot to foot, working his nose hard with tissue. He crumpled it, jerked a thump at the rollers. He smoothed 100 on the counter and said, "One dog playing and in a hurry." The man in the car there says you get to keep the change, except for a dollar. I want a new back one of those. Then he finished the order wide-eyed and grabbed 100 without a word. He tucked it with the big bills in the back of his pouch and pulled a single from the front, the tip that girl had left, and made to hand it over, but then quickly realized his mistake, a $97 tip, yet he couldn't move. In all his 57 years, dead ends, and bad situations, even in that hotel room in the city with his little brother 23 years ago, too scared to count all that money after the job that would land them both in prison and make his beloved Stella disappear, what was this feeling? What was that scent? He knew now that there really was something in the air. This time, Denny brought the dollar bill up to his nose and breathed deeply. August 7th, 1963, Coney Island was bright and clean on a beautiful summer day. Stella Dorchester, a petite girl with a face like polished mahogany, was happiest and prettiest on a boardwalk by a sparkling ocean. He wanted to give her everything, anything, once. Once, he thought again, squeezing her hand, just once, and he'd have the cash so they could get married finally, and she'll never need to know where it all came from. Memories and money, paper trails that are meaningless and peppered with inaccuracy. The ocean had sparkled back then, but not with sunlight. There had been plastic things in the waves that day, trash blown down from the walk. And at her best, Stella had been spoiled and moody and selfish. But he had loved her more than anyone. Back then, her hand warming his, Denny had felt something deep enough to convince him that he could get away with anything up to and including bank robbery. He breathed in and shut his eyes. He thought of Stella, Stella in the prison dreams, how he had dreamt not about her but for her on her behalf, as if that could make her wait for his release. His cellmate, Hunky, an immigrant who liked to stretch the truth, had gotten arrested almost as soon as he'd stepped off the flight from Italy. It was any one of a million summer nights, prisoners smoking stale cigarettes, turning currency to ash to sleep and dream like citizens. Hunky in the middle of a story that may not have been true about a cousin who lived in Brooklyn and spoke little English and still heard Celador as Stella Dior and so thought that nonsense English phrase the most beautiful thing he'd ever heard. But before he could remember what was so beautiful about a Stella Dior, Denny, for the first time since prison, imagined visiting Stella Dorchester now, after all these years apart. What might happen if he somehow got the address, showed up on her porch this evening, holding a rose that smelled so sweet and soft, his face a glittering ocean, his eyes like stars of gold. But then he looked at his hands. There was only peach-colored paper there now. The driver had snatched the bill before taking off, leaving only his used tissue for Denny to throw away.
This is Wider Window of Poetry on KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. My guest is Ulrich Casimir, and he's about to read us another short story.
Sure. This one's called Phantom Power. I'll just go ahead and jump right into this one. Okay. Manuel's no-show job kept him 8 to 5 down at Carson Cement, So it was Linda's responsibility to have the house cleaned and dinner fixed and the recliner angled right and the remotes in clear sight and Manuel's drink, a screwdriver with a mandarin key lime mixture made from scratch, ready for the man the moment he got home. She had always kept a clean home, so that part was simple. Tidying, some picking up, a bit of careful dusting, making sure the rag she used on the borders of the flat screen TV didn't leave yet another expensive, injurious scratch on the face of it. She had to close the curtains too, because it was part of what he wanted, how he liked things. Dinner was potatoes, mashed or roasted with onions, olive oil, rosemary. The beans Manny liked came out of a can, but the meat, steak or chops, depending on the sale at Ray's, had to be cooked over charcoal and that little grill by their back door. The recliner was simple, or simpler, ever since Linda started marking the angle he liked best with a felt tip pen that barely showed, a mark only she could see. The remotes, too, were easy. It was the drink that took longest and had her panic now. They lived in an old Levittown ranch in the 50th block of Allen Avenue. It was 5 o'clock p.m., and through their living room window stretched the Tehachapi Mountains and the wind farms to the east, the shuttered women's prison to the west. On that clear spring afternoon, Linda pulled the curtain shut, thinking solely of her husband, what he liked and what he wanted. 5 minutes later, the house was ready. Dinner cooking, recliner remotes ready to go. She went to make the drink and realized she'd forgotten to stop by Ray's on her way back from meeting Tommy at Haversack's to pick up the oranges she should have picked up when she'd gone when she said she was going to go, which was this morning. One orange left, a can of juice, a half-finished pint of lemonade. She would have to fudge the mix and pray he'd be too high to note the difference. By 10 past, she was squeezing the halved orange with one hand and measuring out the vodka with the other. There were key limes, at least. Linda quartered one, squeezed it into an ice-filled tumbler, and added vodka, juice, mint. She finished at 5:12, 2 minutes late. Rather, he was 2 minutes late, and while this was abnormal, she was grateful. Linda could feel the pork sizzling out back. She could smell the potatoes steaming, drying out in the oven. The house was empty and quiet and dark. And although she could not explain the sensation, she felt the danger threaded through this place, like the movement one feels in a bound-up spring. She checked the oven twice, thrice, turned it down, reset the timer. She went out back to flip the chops and stoke the briquettes. She went back inside and straightened cushions and drew drapes until they covered the windows perfectly, until the light outside pushed at them like the air, the skin of a balloon. 20 past came and went, and her husband was now later than she'd ever known him to be. And the more time passed, the less relieved she felt, the heavier with dread the air in that house became. At 23 after, she could stand it no longer. Linda went out to check the mail. Bills, an Easter card from Manuel's mother. Credit offers, which Manuel always forbade her to open, which he had instructed her to immediately toss into the grill. She took the junk mail out back, burned it, and suddenly there it was again, that feeling again. Grief, worry, relief? Maybe, she thought, he had had an accident. Maybe his motorcycle had been sideswiped and he was face down on the culvert by Highway 58. Maybe, just maybe, he'd still be there tonight, late tonight, crying out for help, mewling like a little baby girl, making nothing but tiny, soundless bubbles in the mud, until she remembered that her cell was on vibrate and in her purse. One call and a voicemail, both from Allie, Manuel's fat sister, a former prostitute who lived with her kids outside of Reno. They'd never met, but Linda had seen Manuel's pictures of her, and she'd spoken with Allie by phone on the holidays. She knew Allie mostly through Manuel's complaints about her, those stories from when his sister had been addicted to everything. It had always bothered Linda that Allie didn't even bother driving down from Reno to the courthouse for the wedding. She'd always thought Allie hated her, so this phone call was a surprise. Linda poked at the screen of her phone and immediately heard a voice that reminded her of Manuel at his angriest, except this voice was higher pitched and it sounded as if Allie had run upstairs to make the call. Linda, she said, kids screaming in the background. Allie here, Manny's sister. He called today, drunker than I ever heard him before. I shouldn't be telling you this, but I guess I'm calling because something is up with him and maybe you too, or maybe the both of you. He's my brother. I can smell it. And that was it. The phone had buzzed twice in Linda's hand as she listened for the voicemail. A couple of swipes and she saw the reasons for it. 2 texts from Tommy. He knows, read one. Run, screamed the other. And Linda's vision instantly blew. She reached behind her for the wall, clutched it, felt it. Her sight began to clear. Her heart began to slow. She put the phone in her pocket and she began to run. She grabbed her wallet and keys from a corduroy jacket in the living room closet. Pall Malls and a pack of matches shimmied into Manuel's Chico State hoodie, his favorite, then bolted out front without shutting off the grill of the oven. 5 minutes later, she covered the 2 miles to Haversacks, the bar off Highway 58 where Tommy Schliemann tended Tuesday through Saturday, noon to close. The place was a glorified double wide on a makeshift foundation, converted over the years into something just solid enough to pass muster with the city. Linda parked her Dart down the street around the corner from the bar's gravel lot. She grabbed her keys from the passenger seat, dropped her cell into the console, and left the car running. She walked around to the rear of the bar where Tommy parked. His was a Monte Carlo from the early 1970s, gray with a half-rotted cloth top and a busted lock on the passenger side. Linda slid into it and felt at the bottom of the dash for the ledge where Tommy stashed his spare. The bar's jukebox was going. Miranda Lambert's Kerosene cranked up nice and hot. She could be crashing around in the Sherman tank out here and no one inside would know it. She started Tommy's car, saw the gas gauge at half, which he told her more than once meant that there was actually just a quarter tank left. But that was enough to get her to Bakersfield. She pulled the shifter down, nudged the vehicle to the road, eased onto her side of the highway, and punched the accelerator hard as she reached for her purse and counted the money it contained. In Bakersfield, Linda slowed, cut across the Mint Avenue to the Chase branch there, left Tommy's ride running as she cinched her hood tight, and went to the ATM. He'd always kept a firm eye on the cash, Manny did, and he wouldn't let her work. So for years, Linda had tried to be frugal with whatever funds he saw fit, to do a lot weekly for groceries and such. She would spend as little as possible, then put the rest in an account, one she'd started the day after their wedding, her own little secret. But 3 years of this had netted her only $200.75. She had a debit card, but she also knew enough not to use it. He'd gone to school with half the tellers here. He would find her in a minute if she used the card. So it was the ATM, even though that meant leaving those precious hard-earned quarters behind. She added the $200 to the $31.55 already in the purse and drove down to fill up at the Stop and Sip outside of town. Manny had never been north of San Francisco in his life. At the junction for Interstate 5 with $179 and little else in her purse, Linda made her first deliberate decision since Allie's voicemail and went north. Didn't stop until she hit Sacramento and had to for gas in the toilet. Filling up at the Valero there was another $55, leaving her $124 in cash. Tommy kept a half-full bottle of Desoxin in his dash. They were there, he told her late one night when Manny was off in L.A. working his real job. So whenever Tommy took a smoke break during a double, he could pop some to smooth out those 14-hour shifts. Inside the Valero, Linda spent another $4, this time on snacks and pop. She swallowed 3 Desoxin in a single gulp and hit the highway again, due north, leaving Sacramento behind, with no real idea how far those bills or her cash would take her. Around 2 a.m., she reached Wairika. The only open place in that silent town where Linda could refuel was a truck stop, a TA, with a couple small islands for regular cars out front. The true trucker's part was out back. 2 rows of diesel filling stations with 16 nozzles each, and a huge parking lot with oversized spaces where worn-out long haulers could stop and recharge. It was a hot and sticky night, unusual for late spring that far north. Because she knew what it did to the mileage of her own car, Linda had resisted the urge to use the Monte Carlo's AC, the one accessory that Tommy had always made sure kept working. She'd long since dumped Manny's hoodie, and although she didn't realize it, the skin-tight tank top she'd been wearing all day was now fused with sweat to her body. And then she saw herself in the eyes of the trucker at the back of the store, the one screwing her with his gaze, up and down through the open door of the beer cooler. He was balding yet had a long gray ponytail. He wore a big black t-shirt advertising a Volvo dealership in Nevada, a brown woven leather belt, and a silver signet ring with a bright red cross on it. He had a paunch, too, that seemed his main source of propulsion. She could hear the store's PA, trucking by the dead, and she watched this man waddle to the music as he closed the door of the cooler and began strutting like a peacock, cutting the space between them degree by degree. And Linda let him.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. This is Wider Window Poetry. My guest is Ulrich Kazimir, who has just left us on a cliffhanger. Please go ahead.
Linda weighed the $57.75 that she had just spent on gas, the $62.25 she still had left, the hunger that had been needling her since Sacramento. She thought of how hard and fast she'd been running, how she still didn't know when and where she would stop. She thought of the fact that her period would begin soon and that she needed to buy something for it any time now. And she let that man come up to her, buy her beer, feed her, and lead her out back to his big rig, which was parked there like a beast, asleep in a den with many other beasts. And when they were done, when he had finished, she had another $100 in her pocket. She also had a destination, his suggestion, the truckers, based on a story his mother had told him long ago about an aunt who'd needed to get away in the 70s and disappear fast. She took his case of beer and her back and with her back to Tommy's club. Linda chewed and swallowed 8 more Desoxin at once, chased them with a lukewarm bud, and started driving again. She stopped and did it all once more at a Flying J near Grant's Pass, this time with a lean and brutal cuss who banged her head into the steering wheel and ripped off a chunk of her hair before paying her $25 less than they'd originally agreed. At 8 in the morning, Linda groaned through the outskirts of Eugene and into the parking lot of a Motel 6 with rooms available at $35 a night. The clerk, a thin woman with pockmarked cheeks and teeth that looked brushed with battery acid, smiled the best she could and let Linda check in early. 16 hours straight, Linda slept, each hour feeling like a death of day. A recovering meth addict who'd been given enough second chances to feel that she ought to pay it forward, the hotel clerk, Sadie, held off the maids and let the sorriest, most desperate-looking guest she'd ever seen sleep 3 hours past checkout. When Linda finally woke, cleaned up, and went to pay, Sadie covered half the balance herself and gave the poor woman one of the motel's business cards with the name, address, and phone number of the Eugene Mission scrawled on back. When Linda got to the mission and saw herself in the mirror behind the receptionist, she remembered the sorry way the clerk had looked at her. She looked a mess, but the mission staff passed zero judgments, asked no searching questions. They seemed to pride themselves on this approach, so Linda left them. They asked about drugs, kids, religion, whether Linda was a vegetarian or vegan, her preference for top or bottom bunk, any issues sleeping in the dark. They asked if she needed a locker or had a bag that needed stowing, if she was pregnant or if there were any gynecological services she might require. They showed her the chapel, the cafeteria, the beds, the barber, the laundry. 3 free days, they said, then $2 a day, and she could earn more than that with daily chores. Chapel was required, and the woman who said this, said it in stone. Linda thanked them all, took another shower. She changed into the pajamas the mission provided and then slept again for another 12 hours. Her dreams that night weren't dreams, but recollections of what she'd recently done. She tossed the plates of the Monte Carlo and left the car idling out back of the motel. She had then used some of the remaining money for a cab. En route to the mission, she got the cabbie to stop at the bus station next to a trash bin where she deposited her license and social security card and Safeway card, anything else that might be used to identify her. Deborah was who she was now, Deborah Clark, the name of the manager listed on the front of the hotel's business card. She'd made those truckers use rubbers. Even the cuss had obliged as if he'd been burned that way before. Who she was, who she had been, was something else. She scrubbed off in the shower at the hotel, at the mission, a rank skin that shed with hard scrubbing, trailing after itself as it spiraled into the drain. Yet the next morning, when she woke to the chime for breakfast served, Deborah threw off her sheets and blankets and began clawing at the air above her, in fierce battle with some moist and enveloping phantom power, a choking thing that she could not see, drowning her in an ooze so thick that it took a while for her to realize that at some point during the night, she had let herself go and wet the bed.
This is Wider Window Poetry on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. My guest this month is Ulrich Kazimir.
All right, I'll continue. There was a man whom Deborah had heard the staff call Sunrise, and at first she thought it was a joke. Twice a week, each Wednesday and Saturday morning at 11, Sunrise would truck in beets, potatoes, squash, and whatever else was in season from the garden that the culinary students at the community college tended to year-round. He was a roly-poly guy, about 2 inches shorter and a full foot wider than Deborah. When Sunrise spoke, which wasn't often, he did it so softly that even those who knew him well had to lean in to listen. And when he walked, he shambled so hesitantly, so lazily, that Deborah suspected the man was constantly stoned. It took her a couple of weeks to overhear his name, another couple more to casually and secretively ensure that she'd heard it right, and another 3 to finagle a way for them to meet privately without anyone at the mission catching on. At first, the mission's emphasis on segregating its male and female guests had made her smile, but what had felt quaint now began to seem creepy and strange, something else in life that had been forced upon her. Across the hall, down from the mission's pantries and coolers, was the chapel. Services took place there every night, the biggest on Saturday nights and Sunday mornings. But the space was almost always empty from 10 to 11:30 a.m. on Saturdays. So Deborah, thinking of Sunrise and the chapel's location near the pantry, picked that time slot for her personal conversations with God or whoever. The chapel was warmly lit, wood paneling running a foot down from the ceiling, mirroring the grain of the lectern and pews. At first, since she was only there to establish the cover of routine, Deborah would bring a notebook and pass the time by drawing faces and sketching the room. Cover for both him and her. Cover for the day when she would reach out to this man who made her smile even when he wasn't around, whom she could hear grunting and groaning as he unloaded box after box, food that he gave his time to deliver for the benefit of the hopeless and the addicted, the homeless and the poor. 4 Saturdays in, though, something changed. Deborah changed, or began to change. She started leaving the notebook in her locker, sitting in the pews, thinking about life, her life, the one she'd left behind. She thought of Manuel, how things had begun with him, what they turned into, how they ended. She thought of God, too, and faith, and will and circumstance, and poor Tommy Schlemann, who used to take her up to the wind farms to watch the stars late at night when Manuel was off in L.A., working, doing to other people what she was pretty sure he'd already done to Tommy. Tommy, who'd loved that stupid Monte Carlo more than anything, would never put his hand on a woman, his hands on a woman in a hurtful way in his life. And then she began to wonder at Sunrise. She imagined his life, what he must be like outside the mission, away from his job. This kind man who looked like a sort of hippie who would keep a garden just to watch butterflies flit and flowers grow. They could keep a garden, Deborah thought. They could find an apartment together, maybe lease a plot on the edge of town, spend next year's growing season scratching in the dirt, digging through the grime that coated them, springing into one another's arms. By her 7th Saturday morning in the chapel, Deborah realized she'd started kneeling and could not recall when this whole kneeling thing had begun. 8 Saturdays in, she was there on her knees, eyes shut, hands stitched together in prayer, when she heard the sound of a body rising from the pew. She opened her eyes, turned to the right, but the large circular figure with a backside like melted marshmallows was already headed back down the hall. On the cushion next to Deborah was a small honeysuckle-scented slip, the size of a name tag, on which he'd written his name and number, and at the bottom, a single word, Namaste, in cursive, festooned with daisies, lilies, fractals, sketched and painted in inks, oils, and watercolor. He said, "I've been thinking about this all day, meeting you, talking to you, conversing with you." And though he delivered this in a whisper, the shape of the chapel sent his plosives and sibilants twisting through space, echoing in the room's many corners and recesses. And she said, "Oh," blushed, looked him in the eye for a moment, and looked down again, this time at the gap between them, which, since neither had moved, seemed to be shrinking on its own accord. "Ah, Chica, magnetism." "Quiet," Deborah whispered. "Aren't you afraid?" Earlier that morning, while cleaning the woman's bathroom, Deborah had, for the first time in a week, caught a glimpse of herself in the mirror. She remembered how she used to look before Manuel. She remembered the state she was in the day that she got to the mission. At her wedding, she was 5'5 and a curvy 135 pounds. Her auburn hair was long back then, down to the small of her back, with curls that flowed into one another like waves of light or communication. She had bright blue eyes and fair skin and freckles that migrated with each change in the angle of the sun. Tony, her bestie in Tehachapi, had wanted to conceal them the day of the wedding, but Linda had said no. Everyone who saw the picture said those freckles added depth to who she was. By the time she got to the mission, Linda had dropped 15 pounds in 2 days. The skin on her face was loose, and there were bruises on her neck and arms, some so deep they seemed implanted far beneath the surface of her skin. Her nails broken, her lips cracked and dry. She left a patch of that long auburn hair in the passenger side of the Continental Long Hauler in Grants Pass. But in the months since, Deborah had gained all the weight back and then some, the extra pounds of happy fat dividing itself evenly between her working bits. She looked curvy again, and although she tried to cover it up, she got the occasional disapproving look from the female staffers. She'd always been proud of her shape. She could try to hide that from men, but never from women. When the bruises faded, Deborah went to the barber at the Mission, a Mexican named Paolo, who was training to be a stylist at the cosmetology school three blocks away. He gave her a cute bob, the shortest cut of her adult life, and she quickly got into the habit of tucking it behind her ears so the back of her head was always where she carried it most. Her lips healed quickly. About a month into her stay, Sherry, one of the Mission's youngest staffers, a college student who'd gotten a DUI and started working there as community service, gave Deborah a brand new tube in a shade of pink that said the young girl had a good eye. And Deborah, in turn, treasured the lipstick and used it sparingly. Since receiving his note, each Saturday morning before chapel, she'd pull out the lipstick and apply it a bit at a time, daubing her lips with tissue until her lips alone seemed responsible for her renewed and resonant glow. She'd arch her back then, push out her breasts and backside then, deciding once again she was starting to like what she saw. So when she asked the man if he was afraid, and he moved even closer, close enough that she could feel his breathing, the warmth of his body radiating in tangible waves. When he put his hand on hers and she snapped her head toward him and looked at his face, she knew. Even before he replied to her question, she knew. "No way," he answered. "I'm not afraid, not even the tiniest little bit. Are you?"
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. This is Wider Window Poetry. I'm Teal Ansari, and my guest is Ulrich Kazimir.
That winter was colder, grayer, wetter than ever, and Deborah, who'd never spent a night in the Pacific Northwest, did all she could to make it through. She read as many books as she could afford to buy from the dollar bin at the downtown Smith family. She snagged a beat-up acoustic guitar in the lost and found it at the Mission, then sat about humming and strumming, picking up whatever she could from any of the few dozen of the Mission's guests who played guitar. And string by string, chord by chord, Deborah began to learn how to play. When she and Sunrise got together, they went for walks in the rain, or picnicked in waterlogged forests, or sat up for hours, chatting in sodden parks and the fields near the buttes. He had an umbrella so large it shielded them together from the drops of rain that often fell, but sometimes swirled up, from the wintry clouds that shielded the entire western part of the state, from the rays of the sun, the stars, even eventually the moon. They were dating. She developed a new gait, as if something dense had shifted from her shoulders or simply fallen on its own and shattered in a million pieces on the Mission floor. No one but the two involved knew the reason for it, but everyone noticed the change. Each Saturday after they first spoke, he would drop off another ornate note and disappear before anyone could see. And each Saturday evening, they would meet a few blocks away near the downtown library and do whatever it was he promised earlier on his note. His given name was indeed Sunrise Zimmerman, and he'd lived in Eugene all his life. His parents, both dead, two hippies who'd met at Haight Ashbury in the 1960s and stayed through its wild decline, had moved to Eugene in the early 1980s, shortly before his birth. He was shy and introspective, spoke louder and more freely with her than she'd ever seen him do with anyone else. And she, in turn, expressed herself with him like she hadn't with anyone in years. Not Tony, not Tommy, and definitely not Manuel. She told him her real name was Lucinda Bunting, that she'd left her hometown of Wairika with nothing, running from an ex who'd like to rip out her hair and bang her head into the steering wheel. And then she told him the truth about Manny and his real job, the contracts he carried out at night sometimes for the cartels in L.A. She said that she could never go back, and Sunrise comforted and caressed her as she spoke, accepting everything she told him without judgment. He was a computer geek, and what he didn't know how to do, his cadre of fellow geeks, some local and some not, could readily accomplish. It was Sunrise, with the help of friends Alex and Matt, who turned Linda Starling into Deborah Clark, at least in the eyes of the government. By midwinter, she had a birth certificate, a license, a passport, and a social security card, all brand new and bona fide, with her new name on. Shortly afterward, in February, Deborah left the Mission and moved in with Sunrise. He lived off a feeder road that led from the southbound side of the interstate to the community college about a half mile down. His house was a cozy, fully carpeted three-bedroom with cream-colored siding. He was a patient, quote-unquote, for migraines, One of the bedrooms had fluorescent lights everywhere and functioning as a nursery, while the finished attic was bisected with black plastic sheeting, with lights and buckets of water and nutrients for growing indoors during the winter. There was a big, well-tended backyard, too, for high fences along which he set up discreet plots for growing when his outdoor season came. It took a while, but Deborah began to think of the weed as medicine, even to welcome the haze that often hung upon him. She began to associate the scent of marijuana with coming home. It took them 3 weeks to clear the adjustment period that most couples spend several months or even a year getting through. She learned that he liked the dust and vacuum, that he enjoyed doing his own laundry and folding his own clothes, that he liked making breakfast but enjoyed it when she made lunch, and he preferred beer, not cocktails. She taught him much about herself too, how it was a bad idea to let her start complaining since sometimes she didn't know how to stop, the degree to which she hated cleaning the bathroom, especially the tub and toilet after a man, the way she liked being woken up for sex in the middle of the night, and how little she enjoyed being frisky first thing in the morning. The first time they slept together was 2 weeks after his first note, but he never let her go down on him or get a good look at his private parts until after she'd moved in. And when he did, she understood why. He'd had a partial orchiectomy in his teens after being diagnosed with testicular cancer. And while he explained this meant he could not have kids, he'd been lucky enough to be spared some of the other effects. He told her this, and she looked at his scar, touched him there, wondered silently how much lower his testosterone must be because of it. And she grabbed his head and kissed him, said that she loved him, all of him, every present and missing part, promised him that she'd do so forever. They married that summer, mid-August, at the Eugene Rose Garden, smaller ceremony, people with mission staffers and current and former residents, ministered by Trillium Starchild, a longtime friend of Sunrise's who'd become a minister online for the occasion. Wearing a druid robe and silver rings on each finger, Trillium Starchild did an excellent job with the ceremony that both bride and groom knew was illegal. She gave them everything they asked for: ID in the form of a driver's license, symptoms, history, all forms filled out in block letters to the best of her knowledge and ability. She had no job, but Sunrise did, so she was covered insurance-wise. She did what they said, went to the desk when called, waited as long as they deemed necessary. When the woman up front finally beckoned and the one in charge walked her back, Linda smiled as if the elegantly coiffed physician's assistant next to her, the one getting paid and not doing the paying, was doing the whole world, especially Linda, the biggest of favors. They took vitals. They measured her up and down and side to side. They asked question after humiliating question, and she calmly and repeatedly relayed the difficult and graphic answers to their questions. No to the discharge, yes to the burning and tingling, a small spot like a welt from a tiny whip on the bottom left flap of her labia. And yes, she answered, yes, it was painful. He was a balding man whose patience and directness spoke to years of experience and level-headed practice. She removed her skirt and underwear. He took a brief look and told her what he thought it looked like, what she thought it was in the first place. The daughter then explained what would happen next, the blood test, and if it came back with the result they suspected, a phone call from the Oregon Department of Human Services, who would register her as a carrier and register phone numbers, request phone numbers of all recent partners. The doctor, as he recited this, was inhumanly calm, and Linda's eyes drifted up to his pate, where she imagined the deep gray luminescence of a rainy winter's day and not the fluorescence hovering over them in the windowless room as responsible for the grief she saw there. Eyes shut, she imagined the rain drizzling on the street outside, spiking the surface of the morass like grains of sand sprinkled from the heavens. She convinced herself that those weren't raindrops but tears, one sheet supplied, that there were actual tears falling from her eye, streaming down her face and falling into the morass, though she'd never known a time in her adult life when she'd actually been able to cry. She began pushing at her tear ducts, heaving herself at whatever it was that was blocking them, wondering whether it was the smell of the office or the strawberry scent of disinfectant that was responsible for her current inability to weep, for this delay in desired and richly deserved weeping, when she felt the warmth of the doctor's hand upon her own. "Wait here," he said. "The nurse will return in a moment and draw your blood. We'll call you in 3 days with the lab results." "Deborah," he said, looking at her ring, "you said you're married?" "Yes, recently." "Yes, and you don't think you got this from him?" "No," she said, thinking of Sunrise, "his limited sexual history." "Probably not," she said slowly, as if listening to herself saying it. The doctor squeezed her hand. "Any reason for us to worry after your safety?" he said. "Because he has to be informed, but there are many, many different ways." "No," she said, My husband would never touch me. Nothing like that. Please, she said, jerking her hand out from under his. He grew tall and rigid, brushing at the pressed eyes of his trousers. He spun on his heels to the door, repeating that the nurse would be in shortly as he walked out. Linda left the clinic before anyone had a chance to draw her blood. She then took a bus downtown, where Sunrise was finalizing an afternoon delivery to a university co-op.
This is Wider Window Poetry on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. My guest is Ulrich Casimir.
That night, she made his favorite meal, plant-grilled salmon with a wasabi soy sauce, ginger sugar marinade, risotto with portobello mushrooms, greens with sliced strawberries and grape tomatoes, drizzled with sweet balsamic vinaigrette. The risotto she made in two batches, one with regular butter and one with enough of his medicated olive oil to make the dish potent without noticeably altering its taste. For the 45 minutes it took to cook the salmon, Linda stood under an umbrella in the rain, manipulating the temperature and force of the grill while Sunrise worked upstairs on his most recent crop. Eight plants were flowering on the far side of the sheeting. She could smell them from where she stood out back, a good 10 yards from the house, a deep and verdant scent. It surprised her to realize how much she would miss it. They had a bottle of wine with dinner, a bright Chardonnay from the vintner Sunrise went to high school with, whose winery was somewhere out in Veneta. She would miss this too, the gently bragging name-dropping part of it. They ate, they drank, they were happy together. They made love twice without protection. The wine and sex together amplified his risotto. By 8:30 that evening, Sunrise was out cold, one fat white leg sticking out from under the covers. When he started snoring, Linda rose, got dressed, grabbed some essentials from the dresser and closet and bathroom, threw them all into a duffel bag, and left the bedroom without once looking back at him. She took his keys, she took his wallet, she threw her stuff into the passenger side of his van, and then went back into the house to the cabinet under the sink in the laundry room. She took out the jumbo-sized bottle of bleach there and poured a cup into the soil of each and every plant in the house. The ones that were flowering, the ones in the vegetative state, even the clones isolated downstairs in the extra room. When she finished that, Linda drove to the bank and withdrew $400 from his checking account. She then returned to his house, dropped his wallet into the mail slot, hit I-5 South, and flicked on the cruise control. She took her time to score around. It didn't dawdle. What had taken her 13 hours nearly 2 years ago now took her 24. At 10 that night came a banging on his front door. Emmanuel leapt out of his recliner, scrambled down the hall, grabbed the .30-06 from the closet, and shimmied with his back to the wall into his living room. He passed out early. His heart was still racing from a horrifying dream. Something, some invisible power chasing him through a shopping mall. And whatever it was had just cornered him in the woman's bathroom at Macy's. Manny shouldered the door open, thinking only of his dream, the stupid mistake he'd made in it, and how he wouldn't be making it now. He almost shot the woman in the face when he realized who it was. Linda walked into his house like she owned it. But it was Deborah who waved Manny's gun aside, shutting the door quickly.
This is Wider Window Poetry on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. My guest this month is Ulrich Casimir, and is that the end of the story?
That's the end of the story.
My gosh. Way to leave us wanting more.
I enjoyed reading that. Thank you for giving me the space to do so.
So you're from North Carolina originally. What brought you to Oregon?
I came out here about 20 years ago for grad school. I just finished my MFA at the University of North Carolina in Greensboro. And I'd worked for a year. In the course of that year, I decided that it'd be smart for me job-wise to go back and get a doctorate. And I got into the University of Oregon. I got some funding. So I moved out here about 3 days before September 11th. That was something. So yeah, that's why I moved out here and I started working. I started taking working on my graduate degree at the University of Oregon. Then I left and worked as a professor at a university just outside of Houston, Prairie View A&M University. I left that job to return back to the Pacific Northwest, in part because I wanted to do more creative writing. That job was a little limiting on that, but also because I love the Northwest. After living here for graduate school, I just came to love this part of the country. It's beautiful here.
Yeah, I was kind of tempted to interrupt you halfway through that story and say, okay, enough with the rain. We know it rains in Eugene.
Yeah. Well, I feel it right now. It's been nothing but rain the last few days.
Yeah, same up here in Portland. And I do have to ask also the characters that she meets in Eugene might be true to life. They might be sort of composites. They might be sort of caricatures. How would mm-hmm. you, what would you say about that?
I'd say all of the above. All the above, but really, one of the things I love about this town that's always kind of captivated me about this town, I'll leave Eugene and come back to Eugene. And for the first couple, especially if I've been gone for a while, the first like maybe 3 weeks, I'm just constantly shaking my head going, what is up with these people? Even though I've lived here before, they're just so strange. One of the things that the story came, that Phantom Power, the last story that I read, that story was one of the ones one of my favorites of my stories that I've written, because it came to me so quickly. It was just like sort of like gasped in the middle of the night, and I was like, I know what to do. And it took a while to actually render it, but it just came to me very quickly. And I think it's because at the time I was thinking through this kind of fairly common phenomenon in Eugene, where folks will move here and suddenly they have a different name. They're a totally different person. It's a very itinerant town. And it's full of folks that, especially around the holidays, it becomes really apparent just how many people live in Eugene, and they come from some really complicated background. Something's up with their family back home. And this is like it's almost like, I think of this town, I've lived here for such a long time, and there are people who are from here, but there are so many people who are not from here, who come here not with the purpose necessarily of reinventing themselves, but rather there's something that they're looking for that involves kind of, in some way, shape, or form, doing that thing that's really sort of a very American thing to do, becoming someone else, right? In some way, shape, or form. And often it does involve changing your name from, say, Rachel to Summer.
Has that changed much in the past year and a half? I think people have been a lot less mobile with the pandemic.
That's a really good question. I'm not sure how to answer that, because I've been kind of locked down too. I've been teaching through the pandemic, and for folks who are teaching on the college and university level, especially, I can't speak before that, but I know that my peers and I have been almost double timing it since the beginning of the pandemic. We've been really working to the bone. So I haven't had much of a chance to socialize and really get out there and talk with new folks and engage the temperature of the city the way I could have before, and I hope mm-hmm. to again soon. That's a good question, though.
Yeah, it's hard when you can't just go out and go to the coffee shop on the corner and just sort of watch the people go by.
Yeah,
it's been difficult. You know, there are signs of life coming back here in Portland. I think mm-hmm. Towns have varied a lot. The vaccination rate here is pretty high, and so that has led to some relaxation of restrictions. But I don't know how widespread that's been in other parts of the state. And of course, the past year and a half seen a lot of political upheaval, certainly here in Portland. What was that like in Eugene?
Similar here. One of my proudest moments as a Eugenian was after George Floyd and the protests that erupted in Eugene. I was at the time, I'm living at a different place, just about a mile away from where I lived before, but I was nearer to downtown. And I think like a lot of African Americans, it's like a weight you've been carrying for a very long period of time. I have gotten to the point in my life where I feel like I'm comfortable carrying it still, but there are younger shoulders. What's really been a positive thing for me is that those shoulders aren't just young, but a lot of them are white shoulders. It's really great to see that sort of white allies showing up and participating in these demonstrations and protests. And I remember I just needed to clear my head and just get out of that zone for a second. So I went out to my back deck. And I was just sitting there, it was late afternoon, and I could hear the sound. And I was wondering what it was. And I realized it was like a couple of miles away, but good distance away. It was a protest. And they were, I mean, it was just, like tears started coming out. I was like, this is what it's all about. So it's been interesting here. You know, Oregon, Portland, and Eugene, especially have very complicated histories when it comes to this stuff. And I always talk to my friends back home about this area. And I say, one of the things I like about here is that even though it's got this really complicated history, I do feel like Portland and Eugene try really hard to make up for its history, really hard. And I have to give it credit for that. I think that's, at the end of the day, for my sense of things is that's really what I want personally, is for folks to try to change and try to do this better.
You've been listening to Wider Window Poetry on KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. And my guest this month has been Ulrich Kazimir. I always like to close with one completely random question. So here's your random question. If you could meet one person from history, who would it be and why?
Easy, Nelson Mandela. He's been one of my heroes since I was a kid. I have been in awe of that man for a long time. One of my South African friends, he actually went to graduate school together. He and I have often talked about just how remarkable of an individual and human being he really was. I'll never forget when he came. I was probably just in high school, just out of high school at the time. But when he was released from prison, and he was being interviewed, and he was asked these really difficult questions about his previous activities, and some interviewers, American interviewers in particular, essentially tried to make the man out to be some sort of terrorist. And I will never forget him getting one of those questions and just stopping and letting the question come in and delivering forth this like really like amazingly precise, well considered, and at the same time, like, I mean, the answer to the question, if you had seen it written down, be like, oh my God, I think he just took this reporter out of the meat. It was just he was just so insightful, so smart, and knew what he was all about. I mean, he's been one of my heroes since I was very, very young. Mandela, Hart. I mean, a close second for very, very different reasons, Prince.
Well, those are two excellent choices. You've been listening to Wider Window Poetry. Portland, stay safe out there and stay healthy. Thank you and goodbye.
tuned to KBOO Portland.